Like I said, I'm Mark Chappell from the U.S. Army Engineer Research and Development Center in Vicksburg, Mississippi. I changed the title of my talk to include a question mark behind the mercury amalgam. This has been a subject that we have been dealing with for about 5 years, actually. And any of you who have dealt with mercury know that this is mercury is a real pain in the rear when it comes to understanding its chemistry. So this has been an effort really to try to understand what we would call kind of natural contamination, for lack of a better phrase, as opposed to maybe lab-simulated type contaminations of mercury. And we're trying to explore the use of XAFs to identify the complexation and the species of mercury in these samples. So I'm going to talk about two different types of samples, soil samples from a contaminated site in Waynesboro, Virginia, and then some debris samples underneath the chemical plant where the contaminant originated from. This is a site about 3 miles down from what's called the South River in Waynesboro, Virginia. There's an old DuPont plant where they used mercury as a catalyst in the production of acetate for about 30 or 40 years. They ended at about 1950, if I remember correctly. And they used to reflux the catalyst and get liquid mercury out of it and then reutilize it. And they had some spills that occurred of liquid mercury got into the drain systems. And they're not really sure how much of it went into the river, but there is evidence that it did. And so focusing our studies on, first of all, soils that were collected from a floodplain. This is called the Shiflet Meander, and it sits between river miles 3 and 4 on the South River. Particularly what's interesting about these circles are where we collected sites, and it turns out that the higher mercury concentrations occurs where, depending upon the change in the floodplain, so the higher the deposition, the more inundated the system was, the more mercury is as deposited. So this is a natural or kind of a deposition contamination that occurred with river processes. Whereas we also have samples that were collected directly underneath the chemical facility, kind of the construction debris, where this is actually a pipe that was had sedimented out and wasn't in use anymore. And when he did the excavations, they stuck a screwdriver into this plugged up pipe, and some liquid mercury came out. So we have two sites where we have mercury. There's no evidence of liquid mercury on the floodplain site. It's only ppm levels. It's not visibly detectable. And then we have sites or samples that we know have had a probably decades-long contact with liquid mercury. So this is a prime, the big limitation for XAFs in terms of natural contaminations is concentration. And so this site really provided the concentrations that we need to look at mercury as it would exist out in a contaminated site. We formed the XAFs work, and I'm going to kind of skip through that. At the L3 edge, we did this work at Argonne National Lab, mostly with Kirk Shekel. And this is kind of a fit of some of the samples, and this fit is really based upon kind of the classical understanding of how mercury complexes in soils. Typically from Skillenberg and the work out of their group, is they typically fit, you always have in mercury in soils, you always have this weird first shell, double peak in the first shell. And this is typically attributed to a split between carbons and oxygens and sulfur atoms that are forming the first shell. And these fits aren't too fantastic. We have better data, but I didn't have it with me. So typically you have a kind of a mixture between these light elements in the first shell and a little bit of carbon in the back shell, or backscattering in the second shell. This is a surface soil of floodplain, and this is its subsurface component, about 6 inches or so down. And this is kind of the classical fit. One thing we noticed, though, is while we were processing this data, actually Ryan Zapparo noticed this out of Brookhaven, is that when you're switching between the different K weights, looking at your chi spectrum, and then doing your Fourier transforms, you actually see in this side of the first shell peak a change in the amplitude with respect to shift in K weight. What that actually means is that for a higher Z element, the K spectra the amplitude usually increases with respect to changes in K weight. So this is an example of uranium oxide, and you can see that in the shell, as we move from a K of 1 to K weighting of 3, the amplitude actually increases. And so we're really seeing the same kind of phenomenon here, that in the first shell, we're seeing an increase in the amplitude. It is suggestive that we actually have a heavy metal in the first shell. And it's suggestive that this may actually be an amalgam. It actually may be a direct bond between mercury and some other heavy metal that forms this, the tightest complex that I'm aware of in terms of mercury, and that's a mercury amalgam. So we began this exploration after that in terms of trying to understand, do we have real evidence for mercury amalgams? Do we have evidence of maybe mercury, some other kind of complex, first and second shell? Or are we really just fooling ourselves, and this really is carbon, sulfur, and oxygen? Keep in mind that this same spectra fits a carbon, sulfur, oxygen type of mode. It's only because we are shifting the first, that we observe the change in the amplitude of the K weight that we actually suspect those curves mean something else. So this talk is about that journey. Try to figure out, are we actually seeing amalgams? This is some mapping data, and this is some contributing data that raises the question, are we seeing naturally occurring mercury amalgams? Something about mercury is typically, if you see mercury in ppm levels in soil, you typically will see it come out into the equilibrium waters, such as in this case the river, at part per trillion levels. And that's about 1,000 times difference than what you would expect to see for other types of metals like lead and such. So it does suggest a kind of strong complexation. When we are looking, trying to understand the complexation of mercury, this is an electron microscopy. This is one of the soils collected from the floodplain. Here we have a backscattering image, and so we see a nice particle coated with mercury. Here you see this is the X-ray spectrum, the X-ray fluorescence picked up from that map. Here you see this is the mercury domain, and it's very neatly overlapped by a sulfur domain. However, it's also very neatly overlapped by a copper domain. So we're seeing evidence of both heavy metal complexation, or at least co-location, that's the best I can say, co-location both with sulfur and with copper. This is actually tungsten. We were actually trying to concentrate the mercury in the system, and we used a density separation, and actually tungsten is concentrated around the mercury as well. I have no explanation for that, but that's just interesting. When we did some of the, we went to Brookhaven National Lab and did some XRF, micro-XRF mappings. This is of the subsurface soil. We had a suspicion that we had amalgams. If we had amalgams, they would occur in the subsurface because we had a lot higher concentrations of things that do form amalgams with mercury, such as copper and zinc. You see here, we haven't finished the co-location plots. Here you see a nice hot spot for mercury, and it appears to be in the same place as for copper and for zinc. And iron appears to be present in these same spots as well. Again, this is suggestive, being co-located, that perhaps there's a complexation that's involved there as well. When we look at the debris samples where we actually have a lot higher concentrations of mercury, we obtained much better maps and actually were able to run some of the co-locations on it. And you can see that, for example, where you have mercury domains, you have very nice delineations of copper domains, as well as zinc. And these are the co-location, these are the correlations between the co-locations. It's got pretty good 0.74 R-squared values between mercury and copper. Between zinc and mercury, again, 0.706, and it's a little weaker with respect to mercury, or iron, which is 0.673. I didn't include it here, but we have a co-locating map between copper and iron, and it's really high. It's on the order of 0.89. So the question is, are we looking at mercury that's tracking with iron, or are we looking at mercury that's tracking with copper and zinc that then is tracking with iron as well? Or are we looking at both? We don't know. This is some of the, we're actually in the middle of processing this data. We had a second run on it this summer, and I just actually got some of this data in, and we're not there yet for sure. But these are the two debris samples that we have here. And if you'll take any time to look at the K spectrum, you can see that example for the first debris sample here. There's some nice matching in the where the peaks occur for mercury-copper amalgam, and then it falls apart to some degree. But then you also have some nice matching for the mercury-zinc amalgam, which is right here, but then it falls apart to some degree. And then you also have some nice matching, particularly for the second one, of mercury, here it is, mercury ferrohydrite, but then it falls apart to some degree as well. These are the linear combination fits. Again, we're not there. We do have a fairly high reduced chi-squares. The R factors are not where we want them to be right now, which suggests that we're still missing something. However, I didn't include this plot. It just sent to me this morning. Most of the misfit in the chi space is actually in the low chi. The high chi, where the high Z elements occur, actually fits pretty well. But most of the misfit is down here, and we have no idea why. It may be that what we're looking at is kind of a mixture between amalgams that are complexing in the first shell between zinc and copper, and then some iron oxide amalgams that Brown's group has shown, I think he's out of Riverside, that they have seen evidence for second shell iron atoms associated with mercury. It may simply be that we're not getting the low K right because we're not picking the right iron oxide. So we have a little left to do to tease that one out. Also, there's no magic formula for creating an amalgam. I thought it would be straightforward and easy. Turns out it's not straightforward and easy, and we still have some research to do to ensure that these amalgams are correct. But I think we're moving down the right direction. And that direction is that the picture of mercury is much more complex, and it's to some degree hidden until you go back and really do some fundamental work in manipulating the XFs and trying to understand why you're getting the energy spectrums that you're getting. So we have more work to do, but I think the direction is that we do see co-locations, very good evidence for co-locations of mercury with copper, zinc, and also with iron. We also see some co-locations with sulfur and oxygen. So we have a real mixed beast of species and complexes that occur from mercury. That's part of the reason why it's so frustrating to deal with. So really, the conclusions for this work is that we do see co-locations. Now, whether they actually translate into direct complexations, we don't have the evidence for that yet, and that's what we're working on now. So we were actually talking this morning some ways to try to get around that. But we think this would be, if we can figure this out, finally get some clear data on this, it would be an important discovery in terms of mercury behavior in the environment. When we review the literature over the last couple of decades or so, there are no literature examples of mercury amalgams. And maybe they just haven't looked, or maybe it was just got too frustrating and they didn't want to look any further. But it could be an important reason for describing why in so many of these systems the mercury is so stable. So for example, at this Virginia site, they have ppm levels of mercury. They only release an order of 10 to the 6th less mercury onto the environment. Most of the mercury is very exchangeable. Very stable. It's rarely exchangeable. It's hard to remove. It's associated with the more kind of non-extractable phases, and no one really seems to understand why. So we hope that this, if we can get this to pan out, the mercury amalgam theory will help to explain a lot of this stability that we see. And that's it. Thank you. Yes. The amalgam itself, amalgams are very, very thin complexes. You know, we're talking one or two molecular layers of mercury atoms. To create the amalgam, I expect we would have liquid mercury to come out, and then we reach a point where we would be stable. So there would be, in terms of a thermal desorption study, there should be differences between free mercury and maybe mercury complex with iron versus mercury that's in the amalgam phase, yeah. I know that's one of the things we actually talked about a little bit about this morning. So maybe we've kind of hit the limit in terms of using the XFs and need to do some further, you know, kind of treatments and then try to go back to the XFs and see if we can tease this out. So, yeah.